This episode of New Politics was released on the 2nd of July, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, how many political staffers does it take to change legislation? We look at the Roe versus Wade decision and see if there's any implications for Australia. And we ask the question, what is a Marxist teacher? I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, recruiter for New South Wales Government.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. There's been a bit of a blow-up in the media this week. It's quite an esoteric issue, and it's the number of political advisers that MPs from the crossbench should be allowed to employ, and it seems that everyone has got an opinion about what the right number is. Independent MPs up until the time of the Rudd government had one political adviser working for them. Julia Gillard increased that to two during the time of the Hung Parliament between 2010 and 13. Malcolm Turnbull increased that number to three, and Scott Morrison increased that number to four political advisers. And with four political advisers and their four electoral office staff, independent MPs had a staff of eight, and the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has decided that five staff is enough and has cut back the number of political advisers from four down to one. David, is this a fair arrangement, or does more staff for MPs mean that we'll end up with better legislation and better political outcomes?
I'll have to be honest. I don't know. Looking at the arguments, and I don't mean the abuse and the name-calling, but the actual arguments, both sides have a good case for it. The independents, and not all independents have, as far as I can tell, jumped up and complained about it. The independents claim that they need a decent staffing level to be on top of everything. That seems reasonable. The government claims that they have refunded the parliamentary library. And to me, that seems reasonable. And if you were to really ask my opinion, I would argue that a institution that values independent, fair, accessible knowledge supported by good librarians is probably a better way to go than to have extra staff who may not be needed. It was Zali Steggall, of course, who tweeted some, I think it's fair to say, intemperate tweets calling Anthony Albanese worse than Scott Morrison. That's an arguable claim, to put that mildly. My opinion on Scott Morrison being the worst Prime Minister we've had hasn't changed, by the way. And so far, Anthony Albanese has been a better Prime Minister. Not a perfect one. There's been mistakes and errors, and this change to the staffing levels may be a mistake. Having said that, though, speaking to ex-staffers, they all said, we knew every election things could change and some of us would lose a job and some of us, or we might get extra. Each parliament changed things so that Zali Steggall should have been aware of this. There's a suspicion there's that she had appointed people before she knew she had the budget for them and now has to let them go. And that's not a very pleasant thing. But a more experienced, a more, say, street-aware politician might have held off making the appointments till they knew what the lay of the land was. I know that some of the minor parties, and actually some of the major parties too, fund extra staff through their own resources, which, of course, is much more difficult for an independent too.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure that going to the media is probably not the best way to go about it. And there was also a suggestion that it will cause the independents to block legislation, and they wouldn't be able to do that anyway in the lower house. But all of this process is probably not the best way to win friends in politics. Now, David, you did speak to some political advisors. I spoke to two former political advisors as well. And former advisors, they're generally going to be a little bit more candid about these matters once they're away from politics. And one suggested that for certain MPs, you could give them 20 staff and they'd still be pretty hopeless. And for other MPs, you could give them the bare minimum and they'd still be a very effective MP and they'd be very efficient and effective in what they do. The other factor to take into account is that electoral offices and the job of an MP, it's a little bit like running a small business. It's not exactly the same, but it's a little bit like that. They've got a small office to run. There's people to manage. There's jobs that all of these people have to be given. You have to have management systems in place. And many people who do enter politics arrive with no people management experience, no office management experience, and little support for how to run these systems. And that's probably why there are so many political offices that are a nightmare to work in and have so much staff turnover. The boss of the office, and that's the local MP, of course, they usually come into the job without having the knowledge or the experience to run such an office.
It's how we end up with Pauline Hanson, say, or Scott Morrison, but we also end up with Ben Chifley and Alfred Deakin. It's a tricky thing, and I think having a couple of day workshop on how to do your job as a minister, and of course, one of the first people you should hire is a very capable office administrator.
And some people have accused us, well, if Scott Morrison was cutting staff to independent MPs, we'd be attacking him left, right and centre. And that's probably true. But that's also because everything Scott Morrison acted upon had political motivation at the heart of it. He did actually increase the number of political advisers from 3 to 4. And that was in the context of holding 77 seats out of 151 in the previous parliament. Although by the end of the term, he was in a minority position. So he probably offered this additional support to independent MPs as an insurance policy in case of a hung parliament or a minority parliament. And, you know, support my government because look at all the extra staff that I've given you. The other factor is that they kept these arrangements where they were given extra staff away from the media and they were very, very quiet about it at the time. And in this parliament, Labor does hold the same amount of seats as Scott Morrison did, that's 77 seats, and you can never tell what's going to happen around the corner. Labor's position might be whittled down to a minority position as well over the next 2 or 3 years. Should Albanese do the same thing as Scott Morrison and also give the independent MPs the higher staff levels as well, just as an insurance in case the circumstances change for Labor in the future?
I think this is a storm in a teacup that will settle down. And again, just to go back to that point about Scott Morrison, one of the things that Anthony Albanese has done is increase funding to the Parliamentary Library. So it's a bit of a swings and roundabouts. Scott Morrison would have just cut the staff and increased his own backbenchers' salaries or made for a better travel allowance or some such that had no material benefit. As it comes down, anything can happen. And maybe some of the more calm backbenchers will find that actually we are actually running the office quite efficiently with less and be happy. Maybe too the government will say, actually these guys are behind, we're waiting on commitments for them. We might have to give them 1 or 2 extra staff so that we can speed up their processes. It feels weird after a few years on this podcast. It feels weird actually allowing that the government might make sane and rational and considered choices after a government that manifestly did not make sane and rational and considered choices. But that's where we are at the moment. That's not a bad place to be.
Oh, well, I do agree with you that it's probably a storm in a teacup. Generally, this is not going to be a vote changer in the electorate, and my feeling is that it could have been played out quite differently, or it should have been played out differently in a much better way. Most people in the electorate don't care enough about it, and there is a feeling that with a $1 trillion national government debt, cutbacks do need to be made, and including political advisers. Labor has suggested that they will be providing those additional resources for the Parliamentary Library to deal with additional confidential analysis to independent MPs. Now, that's not exactly the same thing, of course, and I'd be complaining too if I had my office staff cut back. But I think it's important to work out what these political staffers are actually doing. And we do have to remember that the system has been abused in the past. The 23-year-old daughter of Barnaby Joyce somehow got a well-paid job as a senior political advisor for another National Party MP. Not sure how you can become a senior political advisor at the age of 23, but maybe the National Party does things differently. Vicky Campion, she was a media advisor too. She moved from office to office, and Barnaby Joyce ended up having a relationship with her and starts a new family. And then we had all those Liberal Party advisors having sex with each other in the notorious prayer room at Parliament House, and other advisors masturbating on the desks of their boss and photographing themselves on their mobile phones. So clearly there are some advisors that have got too much time on their hands. They've probably got a few other things on their hands as well. And I know that I'm highlighting the more egregious examples of political behaviour. Most political advisors and staffers do work very hard, but in this case, it's probably better to reach some kind of balance, perhaps two political advisors, taking the number of staff up to six for each independent MP. Maybe that's a compromise that everyone can work with.
One of the arguments is that the crossbenchers will get more stuff than a Labor backbencher. Now, again, how much of this is true and how much isn't, I don't know. And I'm not accusing anyone of lying. I think there's a lot of misinformation and assumption out there, and that gets filtered through journalists and others. And in a game of broken telephone, what is not quite right gets reported as facts. I am speaking genuinely and honestly here. I don't think there's anyone trying to deliberately deceive the public in this case. And I know that there's now an anti-Zali Stegall movement, but even I think Zali spoke from anger rather than any attempt to deceive. I don't agree with how she said or even what she said, but I'm trying to be fair here. It's a weird situation we find ourselves in that no one knows and no one seems to know. If it is true that the Labor backbencher has less staff than the crossbencher, someone should be informed as to why this is, and is that a good thing, and which is the right level of staffing. And, of course, that point you made earlier, you could give certain people 100 staff and they'd still be hopeless, because it all depends on who's in charge.
And the other issue that's starting to be pushed by the opposition, and of course it's being supported by the mainstream media, is this idea that the Prime Minister is spending too much time travelling and not enough on domestic matters. And they've started using the slogan of Airbus Elbow. I've got to admit, that hasn't got the same ring as "it won't be easy under Albanese," but it is just as lame. The media also attached the name of Kevin 747 to Kevin Rudd when he became Prime Minister in 2007. And Albanese has been overseas to the Quad meeting in Tokyo. He made a trip to Indonesia. He's now in Madrid for a NATO meeting. He'll go off to France and possibly Ukraine. And then he'll be in Indonesia again for a G20 meeting. The media never made a fuss about Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull or Scott Morrison travelling frequently. And David, you and I certainly didn't complain about it. But as a comparison, Morrison made 5 overseas trips in his first 3 months as Prime Minister, 8 trips in the 2 months after the 2019 election. Malcolm Turnbull also made a similar number of overseas trips, as did Tony Abbott. Kevin Rudd, contrary to perceptions, actually made less overseas trips than any of these prime ministers. Now, prime ministers do have to make overseas trips, especially events such as G20, a NATO meeting, and for sure they do need to take into account domestic concerns or make sure that there isn't a perception that they're spending all of their time overseas. But what are prime ministers meant to do? Are they meant to refuse the invitation, send their deputy in? And it's not like the prime minister is doing nothing on these trips or sightseeing, although that's what Scott Morrison did do on his final trip as prime minister in Britain. Attending these meetings is an important part of the job of prime minister.
While there are a lot of meetings that can be done on Zoom and online and what have you, I think it is important for the initial trip for the Prime Minister to go over, shake hands, have eye-to-eye high-level meetings, and don't forget the damage that was done by the last government. Here come the one-star reviews. These guys are biased against the coalition. But there was a lot of damage done. We nearly wrecked our relationship with France. China looked at us a lot differently to what they did. Indonesia was mistrustful. We lost the Solomon Islands to Chinese influence. What Anthony Albanese and Penny Wong have had to do is go over, sit down and make assurances that it's a new game. We are totally different. This is how we're going to fix things. This is what we propose. And sometimes that's better face to face. Now, if Anthony Albanese is still going overseas in 6 months' time again and again and again, that may change things. But again, that will depend on the circumstances. But nonetheless, these early flurry of overseas trips, I think, are probably necessary just to try and return Australia back to some kind of geopolitical equilibrium.
Well, it's also a case that generally it's Labor Party prime ministers that tend to cop a lot of this criticism about being overseas too often. Gough Whitlam copped a lot of criticism for spending too much time overseas. So did Bob Hawke. Paul Keating did as well. Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard a little bit, not as much. And now Anthony Albanese. As far as being overseas or whatever the case might be, like, these are government-to-government conversations, government-to-government talks that do need to take place. Climate change is a big issue all around the world, and Australia has changed its position on climate change compared to what the previous coalition government did over 9 years. So these processes and these protocols need to be followed. Prime ministers do need to go overseas. They do need to meet other heads of governments from all around the world, Europe, America, Southeast Asia. That's what prime ministers do. So I think a lot of this criticism at the moment is churlish. But having said that, prime ministers do need to be aware of how this can play out politically and make sure that it doesn't become a political problem egged on by the media.
One of the last public statements from Scott Morrison that anybody listened to was he hadn't been on an overseas trip since Hawaii, which I don't think came out as well as he wanted it to. That play for public sympathy just didn't work. And yes, there are times to go overseas and there are times to not go. And usually too, if there's an emergency, the Prime Minister will come straight back. Whitlam in 1974 with Tracy. There is a pattern of Prime Ministers being on call, and if something goes wrong, and ministers too, and they're on holidays, they come back. And that's part of the, I guess, the downside of the job, that holidays are only holidays while you can afford to take them. Now, I know that there's a lot of people out there who will say, yes, that's the same in my job too. And that's absolutely true, and that's absolutely fine. It doesn't make it any less of a responsibility that everybody does it. I guess the real test is that if there is some kind of national emergency, which of course we hope there isn't, but if there is, that how quickly does the Prime Minister come home, and what circumstances was it that delayed him or her?
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
All good children need traveling shoes. Drive your problems from here. All good people read good books. Now your conscience is clear. I hear you talk, girl. Now your conscience is clear. In the morning when I wipe my brow, wipe the miles away. I like to think I can be so willed and never do what you say. I'll never hear you and never do what you say. Look, my eyes are just holograms. Look, your love has drawn red from my hands. From my hands, you know you'll never be more than twist in my sobriety. More than twist in my sobriety.
The Roe versus Wade decision from 1973 has been overturned by the US Supreme Court, and the original ruling supported the constitutional right of a pregnant woman to choose to have an abortion in the United States. This decision has reverberated all around the world, and although the decision doesn't practically or legally go past the borders of the United States, Roe versus Wade has been used as a precedent in other countries to amend or remove abortion laws, and as a universal symbol for a woman's right to choose. And women in other jurisdictions around the world are now wondering if this repeal of Roe versus Wade in the United States will have a flow-on effect in their own countries. In Australia, there are still ongoing reforms to abortion laws. It was only fully decriminalised in New South Wales in 2019. and in South Australia in 2021, but there is a general bipartisan support for access to abortions, and any changes to abortion laws in Australia are likely to protect rights for women to choose rather than diminish them. But overturning Roe versus Wade in the United States shows that laws and precedents can never be taken for granted.
We've dodged a bullet because the types of people who wanted Roe versus Wade overturned were the types of people who were just in government here. And we're seeing a lot of noise from the opposition in favour of it, from people who support the opposition in favour of it. It could have happened here. I believe that there are still some issues with abortion in some states in Australia. I always thought Bill Clinton got it right when he said abortion should be safe, available and rare. And by rare, I think he meant that the economic choices that women make to have one, and they're valid choices, don't get me wrong, are not there. So the affordability of a child isn't a problem. The other thing too is that for the law and order mob, Freakonomics did the study and found that once abortion was legalized, the crime rate dips 15 years later and stays low in the States because you don't have these kids born in really bad circumstances and parents who can't afford to keep them. I've known a few women who've had abortions. It was not an easy decision for them. It was not done flippantly, and they were made to feel awful about it. And that's not right either. It's a decision that once made should be available, should be safe, and you should be looked after about it. I don't know what's going to happen in the States now because the problem's not going to stop. And a couple of American historians have pointed out that this has only been a problem since about the 1950s. Before then, abortion was a thing that you could get in the States and was seen as a fact of life. I think it's short-sighted. I think the Biden government, my suspicion is that they're waiting for the midterm elections, which at the time of speaking, it looks like they're going to win, going against the trend of the last 30 or 40 years, where then they can do things like maybe expand the court and put on judges who can outnumber, or maybe that they will codify into law federal abortion laws. Certainly, we are seeing the result of Trump. He was able to appoint three justices to the bench of the Supreme Court, and that gave the conservatives a majority. Now, it was a conservative judge, by the way, who did the ruling on Roe versus Wade. So again, it's not the right wing we dislike. It's this hardline, narrow-minded, profit-driven, cultureless, unintelligent, corrupt right wing that we don't like. Anyone who'd put up Kavanaugh as a judge, there's a problem when there were many, many, many better candidates for Supreme Court justice. And it was blocked. Merrick Garland was meant to be and was blocked by the Republicans. And then they were able to get in Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. And again, judges are allowed to have political opinions, but at the basis of everything should be the law. And the law is only ever good when it helps and protects those that are in most need of it. And that's where the Supreme Court fails.
So in this recent case, the US Supreme Court voted 5-4 to overturn Roe versus Wade, and I just assume that this would never actually happen. Roe versus Wade has been chipped away at various times over the past 50 years, but it has always been affirmed by the Supreme Court each and every time over the past 50 years. And because of those precedents and the public comments of those appointed judges to support precedents during their nomination speeches, I just still assume that it wouldn't happen. As you mentioned before, Donald Trump did have that unusual position of appointing three Supreme Court judges during his presidency during 2016 and 2020, and that tipped the balance of the court towards conservatives. But this decision and the way that the Supreme Court is currently set up in the United States, it's a decision and a process that's out of kilter with public opinion. In the United States, 61% of people believe in a woman's right to choose. In Australia, it's actually much, much higher. It's at 81%. And a few people have asked us whether the overturning of Roe versus Wade could be overturned itself, and whether this is something that could actually happen in Australia. As you mentioned, David, the Democrats could increase the number of Supreme Court judges to 13 or whatever the case might be and work towards overturning the decision. This would actually take a long time. It would be a protracted process, and that would probably then further encourage future administrations to keep adding more judges when they don't like decisions that the court has made. So that's all in the United States. As for Australia, there just isn't enough electoral or political support for removing these rights for women. Many political leaders from all sides of politics have come out to condemn the US court decision and condemn it quite strongly. And although it doesn't affect anything legal in Australia, there is a possibility that it could embolden some Australian politicians. The National Party Senator, Matt Canavan, he was highly supportive, as was Bernie Finn, the independent MP in the Victoria Parliament. Now, both of these guys are conservative Catholic, especially Bernie Finn. In Victoria, he's now independent, but he was previously a Liberal Party MP. And before that, he was an MP for the Democratic Labor Party, that old conservative and reactionary BA Santa Maria movement that destroyed the Labor Party for a generation. But the problem here for me is, well, what else can be repealed? Same-sex marriage, same-sex sex, contraception, marriage laws, the reintroduction of segregation, apartheid. Now, you can never be certain how long rights can last as well. Last week, a hard-earned right existed in the United States, and now it's gone. And it may come back again, but it just goes to show that the fight never ends on women's rights and human rights anywhere in the world.
There's already talk. I saw a Texas representative not only wants to secede from Texas, but has suggested bringing back segregation laws. This is frightening. Roe versus Wade is frightening. I say this as a man who will probably never be affected by it, but it's really frightening. It's also, I don't know, you take on women at your peril. As someone who relies on electoral success, you take 51% of the voting public very seriously. You're going to get women who agree with Roe versus Wade. I think there are more women who were in favor of Roe versus Wade than weren't. And when you put in the number of men who are in favor, you've just angered a whole segment of the community, and it's going to end up badly. With Trump in a lot of trouble, seemingly, these types of things aren't going to last. We could be seeing the whole collapse of the American system. We could be seeing a whole reformation of the American system.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud, and Amazon Music. Or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
At a recent address to the Sydney Institute, Senator Holly Hughes was asked why young voters had deserted the Liberal Party at the last election, and here's what she had to say about that.
So I think one of the issues, and again, Dave's, you know, out on the ground as a lower house member, but we've got an education system that's basically run by Marxists. Yes. And so when kids are at school and they're being taught all this absolute left-wing rubbish, that's where they're leaving school and that's where they're landing. So when you've got a problem in your education system, it's going to take your generation to fix it. Maybe their parents need to turn the internet off for, you know, to 1 hour a day, that stop them allowing them to use the car and then get public transport.
Now, it seems that whenever there's a problem for conservative politicians in Australia, they always blame Karl Marx. And I'm not sure if the Liberal Party realises this, but Karl Marx died 140 years ago. And instead of blaming Karl Marx, they should be looking at themselves for creating their own problems. And I don't know what a Marxist teacher actually looks like. Do they wear a beret, the grey shirt with the hammer and sickle badge on it? Do the men and women grow these socialist-style goatees? Do they all look the same? But whatever they look like and wherever they are, did Marxist teachers really cause the demise of the Liberal Party at the last election? And are there too many Marxists in Australian society?
Clearly. Everyone I know is a Marxist. And we all go down, we sing the International and agitate for revolution of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie. We, you know, I don't know where these people get off. I really don't. And they don't understand Marx. I'm not a Marxist, but I've read Marx, which puts me ahead of a lot of the critics of Marx. Marx actually has a lot of very decent things to say about the capitalist system. He called the book Capital, and he looked at how the system works. Now, where he falls down, I think, is his solution to it. I don't think it's going to play out as inevitably as he thought he would, and so far I've been right.
But, David, I'm just wondering, where are these Marxists that Holly Hughes and the conservative politicians are talking about? I just don't see them. Maybe I'm not looking in the right places.
The teachers I know, even those who veer to the left, and not all teachers veer to the left. There are liberal voting teachers. There are apolitical teachers. Teachers are a big enough segment of society to show that they're actually a microcosm of society. They touch every part of the political spectrum. I know of teachers who refused to get a vaccination and are no longer teachers. I know of teachers who do think that the system is corrupt and needs a revolution. There's very little opportunity for you to push Marxist or any ideology in the curriculum, at least in New South Wales and Victoria. I'm assuming it's the same for the rest of the states. And the only reason I'm hedging there is because I haven't seen the curricula in the other states. But I'm pretty sure that it doesn't have, right, weeks 3 through 7, the proletariat, who are they? Sit down, Johnny. This is Mr. Smith's Year 7 maths class. You're going to learn Marxism here. Next week, we're doing Leninism, Maoism. We're going to look at Castro. Holly Hughes has clearly never walked into a school except when she was at school. I doubt she did very well at school. That's neither here nor there.
Well, all of this is rhetorical rubbish, and we can see the continuation of that Sky News-influenced MP, people such as Holly Hughes, Matt Canavan, Bronwyn Bishop. She's no longer a senator, of course, but it's of the same ilk. They push this argument that Marxism has infiltrated schools and universities and socialism is to blame for all the problems in the world. Unions are bad and causing the demise of conservative politics. And what they can never explain is if these imaginary Marxists, socialism and unions are causing all of these problems for right-wing politics. Why has the Liberal National Coalition been in federal government for 20 of the past 26 years? And it's just such a boring and predictable caricature, and it's a deliberate framing. And Holly Hughes also said this about the teaching of economics.
But we do know that in the education department there is a very strong left-wing bent, and anyone that denies that either doesn't have kids at school or aren't seeing what's happening, even with the curriculum. The curriculum is moving so far to the left these days. We know that it's all John Keynes, if not Marxism, rather than Adam Smith.
Are you referring to climate there, or is it across the board?
It's across the board. We know there's a left-wing bent across all of the political correctness we're seeing.
And this is all garbage as well. It's not as though John Keynes is some unknown, obscure figure. He's probably one of the leading economists of the 20th century, and his economic theories still influence politics today. And if you look at the JobKeeper program from 2 years ago, the Liberal Party also seems to be a big fan of Keynesian economics too. And I've had a look at bits and pieces of the curriculum in various states, and in the current economics curriculum, Adam Smith and Keynes are almost given equal weight. Friedrich Hayek, the architect of disastrous neoliberal philosophy, he also gets a mention as well. So there's room for everyone in the curriculum, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So what Holly Hughes is saying is totally incorrect, and pushing this agenda of mistruth and playing out these old cultural war games from the 1960s and the 1970s, it's actually people like Holly Hughes and the new opposition leader, Peter Dutton, who are causing the demise of the Liberal Party with their inane and pretty insane commentary, and it's not actually doing the Liberal Party any favours at all. Peter Dutton did say that the party he leads is not a moderate party, and it's not a conservative party, but it's the Liberal Party. And it's pretty obvious that it's not a Liberal Party and it's not a moderate party. It's a conservative party. And they're very happy to keep pushing this and supporting it with some pretty low-level anti-intellectual thinking.
I mean, I doubt they've read Adam Smith. Margaret Thatcher, of course, quoted Adam Smith very selectively. It's like conservative Bible readers. Skip out all the inconvenient bits, just do the bits that sort of agree with what you want to say and then take them out of further out of context. Adam Smith liked profit. Yes, he did. And Adam Smith was, of course, he was a professor of moral philosophy at Glasgow, and he thought that profit had a morality. Now, when he talks about the invisible hand of economics, he's not talking about the hand of God directly. He is talking about the notion that the market will do what's right. Now, we've found that he's not quite right there. The market does what is most profitable. Maybe there's a sense in that that's what he is thinking. But he also thought that profit should be used for the greater good. This is where people tend to leave Smith. Walking around and seeing, for example, people buying extra luxury goods with their profit horrified Smith. He thought that public utility could go back into
improve housing, to help the poor, to improve education, to give better health services. All of that was what Smith saw as the good of private profit, whether through taxation, whether through donation. That was Smith's view. I bet Holly Hughes doesn't know that. Marx, again, a very useful critique of how capitalism works. Its whole thing is to protect itself. Uses, exploits the workers, maybe, maybe not. That's a whole other argument. But certainly the person who controls the means of production does more in the process of producing than the person who owns the mean of production. Now, and again, the argument can be made, well, the person who owns it put up the money and took the risk, and Marx addresses a lot of them. But other writers later pointed this out as a weakness of Marx. And of course, John Maynard Keynes was in favour of private enterprise. He just thought that governments did things a little bit more efficiently and that government had a right to keep the economy alive by helping people through better tax use, through injecting cash where cash was needed, etc., etc. I don't think Holly Hughes understands any of this.
Oh, well, I guess the key point is that the economy should be working in the interests of people, not the other way around. And that's the issue that's been lacking over the past 30, 40 years of neoliberal economics. And that's the key issue that has been missing. And on that subject of the economy, Peter Dutton also suggested that pensioners should be able to earn double the amount before their pension is actually cut. Currently, it's $300 per week. He's suggesting that the threshold should be raised to $600 per week. Funnily enough, he had 9 years in government and not once did he raise this idea, but maybe good things take a little bit of time. But this is all in response to staff shortages across the workforce, and especially in aged care, early education, teachers and nurses. Now, the nature of work in all of these sectors is pretty hard work, and I'm not too sure if getting pensioners who are enjoying their retirement life to fill in the gap is the right idea. And all of these issues are primarily state-based issues. But what do you think the Labor Party can do in response to these issues in the short to medium term? And is getting pensioners to fill in the staff shortages the right way to go?
No. One of the reasons people don't like to pick fruit, for example, and that was one of the, is that it's very hard work and it's very poorly paid. And not all fruit growers, of course, but there are those fruit growers who try and pay even less. Also, if you're over 65, the physicality of the work is probably beyond a lot of even fit people. So I don't see what the point is here except to, for the Liberal Party to throw a bone to some of its supporters by saying, oh, here's an idea. But like most of these ideas, it's not thought through, it's bad, and it's not going to get up anyway because the practicalities of it. You know, we're going on our retirement grey nomad trip around Australia. Oh, where are you going? Oh, firstly, we're going down to Leeton and we're going to pick grapes for a while, and then we're going to head out to Parks. We'll pick some avocado and then up to Armidale.
And then do a bit of teaching on the side as well and look after some young kids in early education settings.
I've been reading up on my Marx and my young socialist youth propaganda, so I'm ready to sit in a classroom and show these kids what it's really about. And, of course, the opposition's job is to oppose, but they've got to come up with some new ideas and not just try the same stuff that worked, I suppose, for a couple of elections just, but given their results has been shown not to work. And I want a great government, I want a great opposition, because that's how things work best. Whether the Liberal Party realises this and removes Peter Dutton, or whether he learns and starts to moderate his thinking and starts to look at a broader and more inclusive policy, who can tell?
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.